Our speaker this evening, Raymond Carr, is an international public theologian. His research interests are theologically ecumenical, historically sensitive, and radically inclusive. Raymond was recently a visiting professor at Harvard Divinity School and director of the Charles Long Papers Project at Harvard. He's a veteran of the US Air Force and has served as an assistant professor of theology at Pepperdine University from 2012 to 2019. And currently he is president-elect of the Society for the Study of Black Religion. Raymond has published and presented papers on theological ascetics, theomusicology, and black religion. He complements his teaching, writing, and lectures with involvement in Engage, a youth theology initiative, which is a Lilly-funded pre-college program at Lipscomb University, guiding students who are interested in constructive theology and politics. He has a forthcoming trilogy in theological ascetics called Theology in the Mode of Monk, coming out next month. Cornel West has described Dr. Carr as one of the few groundbreaking and path-blazing theologians of his generation, and described his forthcoming trilogy as magisterial and a work that gives us new terrain in our grim and dim times. So please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Raymond Carr.
I want to thank you all for this warm introduction and welcome here today. And I'm so honored to be in this space with so many of you. Some of you already told me, I met you outside, that you drove from a distance. You bless me with your presence. I'm so grateful for that. I come today from Malibu, California, the ancestral home of the Chumash tribe, where Malibu was first pronounced Malawu, which means the roaring waters. And sometimes at night when all the noise dies down, I can hear those waters. And I'll say more about that. But before I go any further, I want to first thank the organizers and sponsors of this event. When I perused the list of speakers, beginning with the very first speaker, that brilliant scholar who helped Martin Luther King pen the speech to Vietnam, that is Vincent Harding, I stand in awe. I stand in a special space. And then there's the brilliant M. Sean Copeland and Al Roberto and many others I can name. I'm indeed in special company. And Dr. Paul Pearson reminded me that no one has missed the Thomas Merton lecture to date. For that reason, I thought I should get here a day early. You know, they tell you that, oh, you know, no one's missed it up to this point. I say, I'm going to get here. And on yesterday, he drove me to the Abbey, where we had a wonderful time walking the grounds with the poet, and he's also a budding dancer by the name of Paul Quinnen. I'd never seen a monk dance before, other than Thelonious Monk. And so it was interesting to watch that. And what a privilege it was for me to walk where Merton walked, to think thoughts where Merton thought, to breathe air in places where Merton breathed, and to pray in spaces where Merton prayed, and to stand by his graveside. Indeed, I enjoy speaking in places and spaces like this one, especially when the topic is one of my own choosing. It's one thing to be invited, but it's another thing to be able to do your own thing, to have your own word, to get in your own groove, and hopefully we can do that tonight. And what this means for me is that I have this grand privilege of introducing you to one of my favorite artists, the jazz legend named Thelonious Monk. In fact, his name is Thelonious Sphere Monk. He lived from 1917 to 1982. Monk was and is affectionately known as the High Priest of Bebop, a brilliant pianist who emerged on the jazz scene during one of the most generative periods in jazz, a jazz period called the Bebop Era in the 1940s. Robin D.G. Kelly, who wrote the definitive biography on Monk, called him an American original. And as much as jazz is America's classical music, Thelonious Monk is the quintessential jazz musician. And as some of you know, I have keyed and attuned my theological efforts to the musical genius of Monk. I think Monk was on to something heavy. In fact, I like the way Dizzy Gillespie, the famous jazz artist, says it best. He said, when describing Monk, he said, deep. The Monk is deep. So what I'd like to do first is I'd like for us to watch this video where Monk introduces you to himself. And there are others in the video who will accompany him and say more about his work. And you can find this online in a piece called Thelonious Monk, an American Composer.
His melodies were beautiful. His chords were unusual. His colors, his rhythmic sense, you know. And the spiritual feeling in the music, you know. When you heard his music, it just carried you away.
The most difficult thing about Monk in the studio was a combination of his perfectionism and his really basic, I think, inability to understand what the hell was supposed to be so difficult about his music. You know, the attitude that he understood it, why couldn't you?
Things that we do in common one to another. And we all do some of the usual things, you know. We use some of the usual phrases. Monk wasn't like that, you know. So Monk was like a real free spirit who said, I'm gonna play this way. This is what I want. And he played stuff that nobody else ever played. Spirit, and probably one of the few people who really stuck to their gun and got what he wanted out of what he wanted to do. You know, there's very few people who make it doing what they want to do. Monk went through a period of not making it, but he still was Monk. When he made it, he still was Monk.
He epitomizes what a jazz musician is supposed to be. He has a style which is instantly identifiable, whether it's in composition, whether it's in his playing, or whether it's someone playing along the lines of Thelonious Monk. It's a very personal approach to jazz.
Everyone treated Thelonious special. I knew there was something special about this guy, because he didn't quite act like all my uncles or his friends, or, you know, and everybody felt very happy. He elicited a real good feeling from everybody in the family all the time. You know, he was big on, like, anytime anybody in the family had a birthday, Thelonious was there to play Happy Birthday, which is an extraordinary event to hear him play Happy Birthday. Believe me, it was not the traditional voicings. But, you know, for a long time, I didn't really know what it was, per se. You know, I would listen to him play the piano, and I knew that he didn't play like everybody. In fact, now in retrospect, as I get older, I would have to say there was certainly a point when I was very young where I was rather distressed that it didn't seem like Dad was doing what everybody else who was a world-famous entertainer was doing. You know, it was like he was into his own thing.
Now, I know that some of you recognize the allusion to Monk's name in the title of my lecture today, Thelonious and the Monk. But I received a few messages that told me that you perhaps didn't know what I was going to talk about tonight. In fact, someone thought that Thelonious was a substitute for theology. I said, well, that's kind of close, of course. It's not totally out of the pocket because I was thinking of theology in the mode of Monk. And I said, okay, that's okay. And then to be more precise, actually what I've been thinking of is that how Monk's music can function as an analog, as a form of parabolic suggestiveness. His approach to musicality functions for me as a mode of thinking. Then, of course, some of you knew that it seemed that you thought the name was maybe a reference to Thelonious Monk and the new movie, American Fiction. But that's not what I had in mind. The question was, for me, is how does Thelonious Monk, the jazz artist on the one hand, tie into the Trappist monk, Thomas Merton, on the other? Thelonious and the Monk, which begs the question, what is the relationship between Thelonious Monk and Thomas, the Trappist monk, Merton? What does Monk have to do with Merton? And what does Merton have to do with Monk? To truly understand this relationship requires a peculiar mode of thinking, of seeing, and of hearing. It requires what I call a peculiar sensitivity to musicality. And it's this penchant for musicality that led me to employ Monk as an analog to articulate my theological sensibilities. Indeed, I think Monk has said it best. Monk bids us to hear the light. I love those mixed metaphors. He's already breaking the categories. Hear the light, mixing the metaphors, stretching the form, bending the notes, and begging us to enter to his own peculiar kind of musicality. And if this is the case, then Monk, through Monk, we can come to terms with a new analog, to think about theology, to think about the movement of God at the heart of the world. Indeed, I believe there's a song playing in our world. It is a melody that sits at the heart of creation. It is a melody that's been playing from the beginning. So we have not arrived in the world without music. Au contraire. We have shown up in a world and we're part of a movement, part of a song. My good friend Willie Jennings, a Yale professor and friend, said it best. He wrote, "When God's feet touched the soil, God was in rhythm, the very rhythm God created with the creation itself. This means that God birthed musicality." Close quote. God birthed musicality. And this, in a sense, is what I mean by musicality. That in the incarnation itself, there is an act of faithfulness by one who includes humanity, all humanity, in a peculiar mode of being. I should point out that I'm not necessarily asking you to agree. I'm simply articulating a vision and hoping that you will hear the light. But I don't expect everyone to hear that light. Not because of an unwillingness or a failure of an explanation or the weakness of an apologetic. I don't expect it because the din of noise won't let us hear it. You're an educated audience. You know what I mean by din of noise, which is that loud and prolonged and noisy clamor that comes from so many different places, whether it's the weed eater in the ditch or the leaf blower in the street, the plumbers in my next door neighbor's home, the trash truck coming up the hill near my house, the Lambo cruising on PCH, a loud, noisy, persistent, and sustained clamor, noise, and the sounds on the street below, and even in Malibu, cascade up the side of the Santa Monica Mountains like a giant amphitheater. But at night, when there's more silence, I can hear the waves. And that's literal noise. But then, and you know what? No wonder I think that monks are always in some isolated kind of location. some place where they can gain some space to achieve perspective, hoping to gain some insight from the silence. But then there's the metaphorical noise, which includes the intellectual noise, the wandering minds of the monks themselves. No wonder Merton wanted to escape to his hermitage. Well, that's not the right word. Not escape. He didn't want to escape. He's trying to get perspective. No, Merton wanted to find perspective in a retreat from the retreat. And knowing Merton as I do, I can imagine that at some point he would have been searching for a retreat from the retreat from the retreat. That's Thomas Merton. But if only we can get to the first step, for we need a retreat from the noise of the 24-hour news cycle, the 365 days of political campaigning and their wedge issues, that quid pro quo, tit for tat of our political class, the political one-upmanship. We need a retreat. We need a retreat from the noise of war and the rumors of wars, from Russia and Ukraine, Israel and Gaza, America and Iran and its proxies, Yemen and other places. It never seems to stop. A retreat for perspective. A retreat for orientation. A retreat for insight from the loud, protracted noise, which precludes us, I believe, from hearing the song that sits at the heart of creation. I can only bid you to continually open your heart to that song that sits at that heart of the creation. Find that song, and if you can't find the song, let the song find you. Let the song find you. In other words, trust the fact that by the right of creation, God already had you in mind. That's finding the song. That's the song finding you already in the beginning. But there's so much that precludes us from hearing, even those who hear the song. And I'm here reminded of the words of Friedrich Nietzsche, who made the great statement, the grand philosopher. He said that those who were seen dancing were thought to be insane by those who could not hear the music. In fact, just the other day, I was walking up the street, up the mountain, and as I passed a basketball court down below, I saw a group of young people who were dancing on the court. And I could barely make out that they were listening to a song. And I thought to myself that if I couldn't hear it, I would think they were insane. It was just the style of dancing that they were doing I just was not familiar with. And even yesterday when I stood outside the hermitage built for Thomas Merton at the Abbey, and Brother Paul Quinnan, he showed me a dance that he does on the property there. And if I didn't know he was talking about dancing and music, I would have thought he was insane. But let me not get too far afield. The Loneliest Monk has helped me to discover that song. In fact, I'm often asked about Monk. They said, well, how did you discover Monk in relation to theology? I said, no, I didn't discover Monk. Monk discovered me. In other words, Monk helped me to find myself through his musical aesthetic. It helped me to find myself within this grand theological scheme of insights and ideas and institutions and ideologies. There's something about Monk that caught my attention, and I want to focus on two areas tonight, and we can talk about them afterwards. There are two areas that I think will ease open a door into Black History Month, Merton, and our current context. The first is what some call Monk's form of individuation. And the second approach I will highlight, which is Monk's mode of improvising on the melody. And we'll talk about the individuation and improvising on the melody. And this evening, I will focus on them one at a time. Normally, I'll start with both those pieces, and then we'll tie Merton into it. But today, I'll go one by one. I think it'll be clearer in this way. When thinking about Monk and individuation, I would be remiss if I did not appeal to a work written over 30 years ago by a scholar by the name of Hugh Roberts. And Roberts, in a very brief piece called Improvisation, Individuation, and Immanence, begins with a look at Monk's spiritual life outside of the church in order to gain a better perspective of Monk's religious awareness or Monk's personal spirituality. I'm not focusing on Monk's personal spiritual journey. That's not what I'm doing. Robinson, in fact, starts out with a commitment to a kind of Jungian analysis, or Jungian analysis, a psychoanalysis that's dedicated to the development of personality. Now, this term individuation is a Jungian term. And I'm not using that. Again, I arrive at a similar place with Roberts because for me, individuation has to do with distinctiveness. Monk's distinctiveness as a musician and as a human being. And you saw some of this on the clip today. And why is this the case? Why Monk? What has Monk to do, again, with theology? What do the various theologies have to do with the Monk? The fact is that when Monk's musical aesthetics is brought into a constructive dialogue as a medium, a parable, or an icon, his music serves our theological and religious imagination by opening our thinking to new and different possibilities. In short fashion, what I'm after is sort of what we heard in the clip. You just watched it. Randy Weston, he described Monk, he said the melodies were beautiful, the chords were unusual, the colors, the spiritual feel in the music, it just carried you away. Right? But it's the unusual, the colors that we're trying to tap. Barry Harris, another beautiful jazz artist, he speaks of Monk's distinctiveness. He says Monk was getting what he wanted to get and still being Monk, whether he made it or not. You see? So it was the musicality that he was after in terms of his sound that was more important to Monk. Thelonious Monk Jr., his son, he mentions how he played Happy Birthday. Right? He said, and it wasn't the traditional found voicings. The point is that Monk was, again, interested in a certain form of musicality. But how did he achieve it? In order to achieve it, Monk first breaks with technique. He even played the piano in a flat-fingered fashion. Did you notice that? Watching him play like that? You're supposed to play with your fingers like a cat. But Monk is playing with his flat fingers. Using the foot pedal to crush notes and tease out other sounds, and even adding notes by pressing on one key and letting go of another to create something like a harmonic cluster, sometimes extracting from the chords. That's how Monk played. Monk played the piano somewhat like a drum or a percussion instrument, which it is. Often, we don't think of the pianism, or we don't look at the piano and we're not reminded that it has mallets and hammers that hit strings that give us sound. But Monk played the piano that way. Monk was accentuating a type of individuality, a type of individuation. And this is part of what I find unique in Monk. And even when he focused on certain notes, Monk would bend the notes rather than blur the notes, because every note was important. The second technique that Monk accentuated when you see his playing that's tied to individuation is it's often called rhythmic displacement. What I mean by that is that Monk does not just strike the notes where you expect to hear them. He breaks with the normal rhythms. As a journalist, Hayden Harvey, this is one of my students, so I like to give her that credit of being a journalist here. As she notes, she says that, quote, Monk's music plays like a conversation. It's filled with inflections, pauses, and abrupt exclamations. The piano keys chatter. They're full of life, as if Monk was sitting across in a chair across the room, close quote. In so doing, when Monk plays with a rhythmic displacement, even silence, which is part of the music, makes its appearance. Sort of like the silence in a speech, which can get awkward like this. I just remember going to the Abbey yesterday and walking in. I was embraced by the silence. Silence shows up. Silence is between every word that I speak. Yet we often don't hear the silence. So Monk had a way in which he made silence a part of the music. And then he had that impeccable style of Monk. In fact, I kept my hat up here today. I just want to wear my hat. Can I wear my hat for the rest of the speech? I want to do that. Here's the reason why. Because we just acknowledge Monk's 42nd year of his death on February the 17th, just a few days ago. And that's important to me because that was also my birthday. It's one of the reasons I'm attracted to Monk. I'll say this also, this is not a part of the talk, but I just want you to know this. I grew up across the highway from the first black asylum in America. And one of the things that stood out about that for me, it was called, by the way, the title, name of the asylum today is Central State Hospital. But years ago, it started in 1850, the asylum name was Petersburg Lunatic Asylum for the Colored Insane. And when you think of a space like that, that has a history of sterilization, a history of abuse, and then you think of Monk running in, if you read Robin D.G. Kelly's book on Monk, this brilliant piece that he wrote, you'll see that Kelly points out how Monk struggled with mental health issues. And it wasn't primarily because of his own use of drugs or anything like that. It was the Thorazine, the lithium, and other drugs that Monk was given. You know that the brilliance of an artist comes in conflict with the powers that be and the way that they function in America. So as a person who grew up across the highway from the first black asylum, Monk was attracted to me. And then the fact that he died on my birthday. And then there are these other things about Monk that makes him so attractive to me when I think of him as an artist. So I'll wear my hat for the rest of the lecture to honor Monk. And there's a sense in when we begin to connect Thelonious Monk to Thomas Merton, we can begin to think through individuation as it relates to Merton. I kind of alluded to it when I talk about Merton moving away from the Abbey itself to the Hermitage. And maybe if Merton had continued to be alive, he would move from the Hermitage to somewhere else. And Merton, in a sense, was seeking his own individuation. There's a constant turning in Merton. And you see this. You see the musicality in Merton as if he's living in a series of conversions. Brother Quinnen mentioned that yesterday, that someone should do a book on Thomas Merton's conversions, plural, not singular. Moving, constantly moving, constantly growing, constantly coming to terms with his own humanity. And one of the places that Merton experiences this deeper note and this turn to individuation is in the monastery itself, in his relationship to music in those spaces. Merton experienced this deeper note of musicality in the hymns, for example. He says this in one of his journal entries. He labeled this entry, Advent Weather. He described it as a, quote, grayish and cold, with clouds of light snow howling across the valley. And one of the things he did in that space at that time was to feed the birds. He says, I, quote, feel closer to my beginning than ever. And perhaps I'm near my end. The Advent hymns sound as if they first did, as they were the nearest things to me that ever were, as if they had been decisive in shaping my heart and my life, as if I had received their form, as if there could never be any other melodies so deeply connatural to me. And then he says this, and I love this part. They are myself, words and melody and everything. Monk speaking of, Merton speaking of the hymns. Martin Luther King says something similar when he writes about the freedom songs. He writes this, King, in fact, he saw the freedom songs as what he called the soul of the movement. He goes on, quote, they're more than just incantations of clever phrases designed to reinvigorate a campaign. The songs, King said, bound us together, gave us courage together, helped us march together. We could walk toward any Gestapo force, King wrote. Why? Because we had cosmic companionship. For we were singing. So the songs moved the civil rights movement. And then there's my friend, my dear departed friend, James Cone, the father of black theology. And Cone said something similar about blacks in America. He says this, that black history is the stuff out of which the black spirituals were created. But the stuff of black history includes more than the bare historical facts of slavery. Black history is an experience, a soulful event. And to understand it is to know the being of a people who had to, quote, feel their way along the course of American slavery, close quote, enduring the stresses and the strains of human servitude, but not without a song. Now, Cone lays it at the end. He says this, black history is a spiritual. And I love that. This idea of seeing history more than the facts of history. History as something we participate in. You see, in German, they make a distinction between these types of terms. In German, you have a term, Historie, which has the facts of history. But then you have this other term, Geschichte. And Geschichte, which you'll get sometimes with this term, where we hear this idea of salvation history. Geschichte is this idea of a story to history where we participate in the life of God in history. A deeper musicality than just facts. Deeper than just technique. Deeper than just information. How much does our arguments over facts miss the deeper musicality of what truth is all about? We should think through that. So Cohn, King, and Merton. And Merton, like King and Cohn, seems to be describing an eventfulness where he was no longer just hearing songs. Merton had become the songs. And for many today, it is as if the music of God in the world has simply become the music of the world. Many of us today are not interested in being a drum major for God or a drum major for justice. We want to march like the prodigal son to the beat of our own drum. And thus the music of God, the music of grace, and the way that was given to us to dance is now taking place in relation to military anthems and marching songs. Songs made for marching rather than dancing. I know those songs. I served in the military. I experienced those songs. Those songs weren't rooted in grace. Those songs weren't rooted in the deeper freedom that we find in the musicality of God. If you want to talk about the difference between freedom in America and theological freedom, we'll do that in the question and answer period. And so what we find that not only is this type of individuation, but we also find this other term that I want to touch on as we turn from individuation, which is Monk's idea of Monk's primary mode of making music, and for me, the most ultimate part of it, which is this notion of improvising on the melody. Now, I want to point out something and be clear. As we think about Thelonious and the Monk, we must remember that Monk did not have divine musicality in mind when he was playing jazz. Don't confuse those two things. But jazz, as I noted, can be parabolically suggestive for those who can, in the words of Monk, hear the light. And nowhere is this more important than when Monk regularly advised musicians in a new age and during a new emergent form of improvisations to improvise on the melody. Improvise on the melody. Monk was often mystified by those who tried to improvise or create solos or even songs by leaving the melody. He would say, quote, "You can make a better solo if you know the tune." It was a keynote to everything that he did. So Monk played his music on what he called, or what can be called, a cantus firmus. And you'll find this when you read books about Monk. A cantus firmus, that means a fixed melody. And the fixed melody becomes the center for the way you move around the melody. And so what Monk meant is that he wanted artists to really consider the melody in their efforts to improvise. To think about how the melody shapes what you're doing. To connect what you, it's sort of like the idea of context. And one of the things that's been lost today in our internet age is context. When I hear young people argue over Michael Jordan and how good Michael Jordan was and whether he played with someone, I think context. We just miss context. You know, this, for those of you who are academics, this is very important because one of the things you know that when you do a PhD, one of the most important parts of doing a PhD is learning how to discriminate sources. It's not about how brilliant you are. It's your exposure to your sources and being able to know what to choose from. In an age of information where there's so much information, we have a loss of context. And so Merton is using the melody in somewhat sort of that way. I'm sorry, not Merton, but Monk. And Monk's preoccupation with creating his music on what jazz artists call on the standard is similar to the advice of a scholar by the name of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. How many of you heard the name Dietrich Bonhoeffer? You got a few hands out there. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was this very important German theologian who was killed by the Nazis near the end of the war. And Bonhoeffer had gone back to fight the Nazis because, as a scholar by the name of Karl Barth told him, he needed to go home because your church is on fire. And Bonhoeffer went back and became part of what was called the Confessing Church, which really emerges sort of after Bonhoeffer and during that time. But nevertheless, the Confessing Church, we'll see that Bonhoeffer, in his prison letters, he once stated that, quote, "Where the cantus firmus is clear and plain, the counterpoint can be developed to its limits." Bonhoeffer extended this view, contending that, quote, "The cantus firmus is the only way to a full and perfect sound. When the counterpoint has a firm support and can't come adrift or get out of tune while remaining distinct and whole in its own right." See the relationship between the melody or the cantus firmus and the counterpoints around it. Bonhoeffer did not think about music at the level of Monk, however. He's a classical pianist. He was even trained as a classical pianist. He was a very good pianist. But he wasn't thinking of harmonies and the more complex and elaborate approaches the melody like Thelonious Monk was. But as I like to say, Monk has helped me to discover Bonhoeffer theologically, and Bonhoeffer has helped me discover Monk musically. Another way to say this is to think that the incarnation takes on aesthetic form in Monk's music, and Monk's music takes on a theological form through the incarnation, even while remaining what it is. It never stops being jazz, but it can become parabolically suggestive. Now, what does that mean? That means for young people in the room today, think of new analogs. Think of ways to think about faith. I just taught a class at Harvard called Theopoetics in the Religious Imagination, and we looked at Tupac, Thug's Mansion, other forms, other songs that allow us to think through the importance of faith. What does it mean? It might be from Taylor Swift for you. It may be someone else. But nevertheless, think of new analogs. Nevertheless, because Monk accentuated the melody in his aesthetic, he can be described as, quote, "hearing the music around the music." For Monk, then, innumerable possibilities exist around any particular melody, for he could hear the music around the music. More recently, I read that Monk actually used improvisations, rhythmic displacements, and melodic variations and interventions and harmonic dissonance to simply hide his appreciation for the melody. I found that deeply intriguing. Yeah, he says, "I want to hide this," sort of like I hide my theology by Monk. You know, sort of, you're working in some ways and where you're making what's familiar unfamiliar, irregular, gaining new insight, rethinking the questions. And that's why theology, for me, is in the mode of Monk. And he's doing this, Monk himself is doing this, during a time where free jazz is emerging and everyone else is reaching for something new. So Monk came across as kind of quaint, in a sense, old-fashioned. And they thought about his approach. A little bit backwards. You know, we don't want to do that improvising on the melody thing that Monk does. But for Monk, it was a possibility. It was a way of finding the new in the old. New possibilities in the way that he embraced and reiterated the past. Don't give up on the past. Rethink the past. And this is part of the beauty in Black tradition. What is it? You signify on the past. You all heard the term signifying before. Signifying is when you take something that comes to you in one way and you move it in another. It's a brilliant trope within the Black community. You can signify in a lot of ways. I can signify in this way. I see you out there with that hat on. I see you, my man, with the hat on. You see, and I said, "Oh, you got yours broken down." And see, that's signifying. You see, and there's different ways to signify. It could just be in a look. Signify. And so Monk does that in his music, where I have this text that I'm working on that's coming after these first three books, and it's called Signifying Monk. Right, which is a playoff of an old folk tale called The Signifying Monkey. Playing with the ideas, reasserting power through powerlessness and gaining new insight and ideas as we deal with the powers. This is Thelonious Monk. And in some ways, this is what we see in Merton. Let me explain how. As we think of Merton improvising on the melody. When I think of Merton, one of the first stories that comes to mind is Merton when he travels down to Forth and Walnut. How many of you are familiar with the Fourth and Walnut? It's got some murder nights in here. The Fourth and Walnut story, which is now what? Fourth and Muhammad Ali. There we go. Yeah, I'm in the right place. Murden's in the center of the shopping district. And Murden encounters the center of life. What happens? Yes, the center of life. Where? In others. This is his musicality. One of the most poignant experiences of God's musicality happened in one of the most mundane places, the shopping center. I mean, if you're familiar with the movie Dawn of the Dead, this is where the zombies go. The mall, the shopping centers. But this is where Merton experiences centeredness. They show up at the mall and these other places. And this is what Merton says. He said, as he looks around, he said, he becomes overwhelmed, this is a quote, with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream, says Merton, a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in a special world, the world of renunciation and supposed holiness. The whole illusion of a separate holy existence is a dream, writes Merton, close quote. And then Merton later says, this sense of liberation from an illusory difference was such a relief and such a joy to me that I almost laughed out loud, close quote. Still, we can ask, well, what was the keynote? What is the ground for this new realization in Merton? Is so clear on this. He writes, quote, it is a glorious destiny to be the member of the human race. Though it is a race dedicated to so many absurdities and one which makes so many terrible mistakes, yet with all of that, God himself gloried in becoming a member of the human race. A member, and this is Merton, I'm just reiterating, and he accents this, a member of the human race. I have immense joy of being human. He writes man there. I put human because he means man. He means human. I have immense joy of being human, a member of a race in which God himself became incarnate, close quote. And then Merton goes on. He closes in this way. If only everybody could realize this, but it cannot be explained. There's no way of telling people that they are walking around shining like the sun. It's clear to me that here, Merton hears the light. This is the Cantus Firmus for Merton. This melody that is at the heart of his musicality, this song that's playing at the center of creation. But if I can take Merton just a little bit deeper, if I could press him just a little bit in monk mode, it is not simply that God identifies with humanity in general. I'm going to press Merton on that. God identifies with us in particular, a type of individuality without being the heresy of individualism. Merton was always hoping, always has his eyes out for a type of heresy of individualism. But God doesn't embrace us because of individualism. God embraces us because our individuation, our individuality, and here I am appealing to the counterintuitive notion of God's simultaneity, where each of us could be a center for God without displacing the other. Each of us. I'm reminded of the disputed quote, so I won't ascribe the quote to anyone. But it's a disputed quote. It says that God is like a circle whose center is everywhere, but whose circumference is nowhere. And so in God's way of approaching time and space, there's a sense in which each one of us is a center. God knows the amount of hairs that's on your head. And so like Monk, if you would think of Monk's way of playing with a cantus firmus, the cantus firmus, the divine cantus firmus, is the one that allows different types of melody to appear in their own way, to show up, to be dissonant, but yet nevertheless to find their place, their own beauty, their own individuation. And I'm watching the time here, so I'm gonna move forward just a little bit to move out of this. Now, and I just want to say before I do that, I want to say something about your distinctiveness. What I hear in Monk when it comes to this, with Monk's preoccupation with every note, is sort of what Oscar Peterson said about Monk. He said that Monk is not doing digital dexterity like the other bebop players. In fact, he's described as the only bebop player who never played bebop. It's not digital dexterity. He said that Monk is pensive, meaning every note becomes important. A note, and this is probably what Monk means by this, that a note can be as small as a pin or as big as the world. It depends upon your imagination. That's the longest Monk. And when I think of such distinctiveness, I think of the fact that at this point, scientists believe that there are 117 billion people or human beings who've lived on this earth. But your life, Paul, your life, Robert, is only lived once. Once. One shot. To hear the song. To live the melody. To improvise. In the dance of life. And Merton, he does this. Merton has his way of dancing around the center. For Merton, it was truly a dance of life. Even those positions that could be thought about outside the cantus firmus, when you look at Merton, you find that he had this way of tapping into things that were outside the abbey. In his journal, aptly titled, quote, Dancing in the Water of Life, Merton describes himself by first speaking of the, quote, need for constant self-revision. Growth, leaving behind renunciation of yesterday, yet in continuity with today, yet in continuity with yesterday's. But then he says, to cling to the fact is to lose one's continuity with it. For this means clinging to what is not there. My ideas are always changing, always moving around one center, always seeing the center from somewhere else. And then he says this, I will always be accused of inconsistencies, and I will no longer be there to hear the accusation. Isn't that wonderful? Dancing, moving, participating, growing. Should we say converting? Merton's viewpoint is an orientation that never becomes his property. It is a ground that's always stable, but shifting at the same time. I love it. He saw this center, this cantus firmus, like a dance. He described it like a dance in the book called Open in the Bible, which is one of my favorite Merton's books. He described the relationship between the freedom of humanity and the freedom of God like a dynamic dance. He uses the word interplay between these two conflicting freedoms and their interplay in history on two different levels. He calls it an ongoing relationship, which is progressive and formative and implies a historical development of human freedom. It's education. It's maturation. By committed interaction and engagement with the ultimate divine freedom. God and humanity together. Point and counterpoint. This is covenant for Merton. This is a participation. This is a partnership. A call and response, a cooperation, a kind of rhythmic coordination. This is Merton's musicality. This is Thelonious and the Monk. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Now to set the mood for our question and answer period, I hope you have time for a 1 minute song of Monk's. You guys interested in that? You gotta hear some Monk. You gotta have some Monk. And in this beautiful song, it's sometimes called This Is My Story, This Is My Song. Some of you would know it as Blessed Assurance, but it's in Monk mode. So I want you to hear this. The foot pedal is part of the song. Thank you.